welcome all of you this afternoon. It's great to have you here and great to be with you. We have a fantastic program for you. Many exciting people to hear from, some things we haven't heard about before in CCB, and I'm delighted to be your presiding officer this afternoon. Let us begin, if we could. All rise, please, for the Pledge of Allegiance. And we have Bonnie Rennie, Chair of our Seniors with Vision Loss Committee, to present the Pledge of Allegiance. Bonnie?
Good afternoon, everyone. Please join me in pledging allegiance. The flag is in your heart. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Bonnie. And for our invocation this afternoon, I'm pleased to introduce to you, to present the invocation, Jacqueline Jackson.
Good afternoon, everyone. Shall we bow our heads? Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this blessed opportunity for the California Council for the Blind of the Blind to come together, Lord Jesus, for networking and educational opportunities. Lord, we ask a special blessing upon the leadership, the elected officers, and the board of directors, Lord. Just give them what they need to lead us in the direction that you would have us to go. I ask a special blessing for each chapter and each affiliate that is a part of this great organization. Lord, bless us tangibly and intangibly with your blessings of prosperity. I just pray that the friendships and the networks that will evoke from this gathering will just truly manifest blessings in all of our lives. Lord, just keep us in the comfort and of your care. These and all blessings we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much. And I might say that that was done on fairly short order, too, so thank you for that as well. I would like to recognize Diana Sandville to make a few announcements for this afternoon. Diana?
Thank you. I wanted to let you know some of the wonderful things that we're going to have bids on at the auction. If you haven't seen some of the items, you can go to the exhibit hall. They are there for you to see. First of all, there will be a microwave, and it is a talking microwave, and you don't have to worry about lugging it home. It will be shipped directly to you if you're the winner of the bid. Then we have a Disneyland collectible, which is Seven Dwarfs. It's really very nice. There is a lovely garden paver, and it is has engraved with CCB in our motto. And there's a CD. It's called This Is for the Homies, and yes, some of the singers are blind on it. There's a really nice bronze statue of a dog reclining. It's a golden retriever, and it's an artist piece, coal bronze cast, and it's signed by the artist. And the LAX 4 Points is given a gift certificate for a weekend stay with breakfast. And that's good through July of 2009. And there is a signed lithograph. There's a picnic basket, which has wine and glasses, and there is a whale watching trip for two, and that is out of Fort Bragg. And the last item is called The Essential Barack Obama. It is a book on tape. And then one more reminder. The banquet people are giving us till 2 o'clock to put in our final numbers. So if you want a banquet ticket for tonight and you haven't purchased it, please do it before 2 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Diana. I'd like now to introduce our first speaker. Thomas Foley is a graduate of the University of California, Hastings College of Law, where he was a member of the Taxation concentration program. His dissertation focused on an analysis of the federal low-income housing tax credit system, the longest single section of the Internal Revenue Code. You know this guy's a glutton for punishment, right? As program manager at the World Institute on Disabilities Access to Assets Program, Tom brings his tax lawyer's planning, plotting, and scheming mind to the world of disability benefits, asset building, and financial education. The Access to Assets Program is designed to bridge the gap between the asset building and disability communities to provide training and technical assistance, advising asset building organizations on how to include consumers with disabilities, and provide outreach to the disabled community. Through policy analysis, public education, and an information and referral service, the access, boy, that's a tough one, you know that? The Access to Assets Project strives to fully engage people with disabilities in the asset building process. Prior to working for the World Institute on Disabilities, Tom spent 6 years as a real estate tax consultant for several boutique accounting firms in Northern California. In addition, he provided financial planning, benefits program consulting, and trust administrative services to corporations and individuals. His training background includes over 20 years of providing disability awareness workshops to government, university, and corporate clientele. In his training experience, Tom has worked with diverse groups of individuals across wide areas of instruction. He has taught first-year law school classes with over 100 students and led workshops and for retirees with only 3 participants. He has instructed law school students in federal taxation, rules of evidence, and torts. He has led workshops for financial accounting benefits professionals, as well as conducting training and orientation for community, university, and student organizations. He also led workshops for people with disabilities, individuals who spoke English as a second language, and even real estate accounting professionals. We're so pleased and honored to have Tom here today. And so I will now give you, without any further ado, Thomas Foley.
Okay. Oh, there we go. Great. Thank you very much. Thanks, Chris. And thank you to CCB for the invitation. I'm really pleased to be here. I've already learned 2 things today. 1, I really need to work on my bio. Yeah. And 2, I'm boring.
It's pretty amazing, huh?
But I'm really happy to be here. And, you know, I'm with the World Institute on Disability. Perhaps some of you know of it. We're a policy research training organization dedicated to the full societal, and here's my favorite part, and economic inclusion of people with disabilities. My program, and I didn't pick the name, is called Access to Assets. And I'm the program manager there. And, you know, we do a couple of things. We work in the asset building community to make sure that different organizations include folks with disabilities. And then we do a lot of disability outreach to talk about what asset building is. We do some INR stuff and stuff like that. And I didn't bring a PowerPoint today, but I love bringing PowerPoints. I love being the blind guy with the PowerPoint and saying, as you can see in slide 4, the compounding interest. Anyway, but I've also been told to drop this in as often as I can. If you have any questions about what we talk about today, have a really difficult email. That's Tom, T-O-M, at WID.org, tom@wid.org. So what is asset building? Asset building, economic development, financial planning, call it what you will. But it's basically the following idea. You know, if you make 20 grand a year, that's great. If you spend 30 grand a year, not so great. The idea is to take the resources that you have, however limited they may be, and put them into things that will generate income and improve your life, i.e. assets, asset building. So that's one of the things that we try to do in the Access to Assets project. And you know, as the bio said, I'm a tax lawyer by training, and I spent a lot of my life planning, plotting, and scheming to help people avoid tax and hold on to as much money as they can. And I was really fortunate to be invited over to World Institute on Disability to do that for folks with disabilities. And, you know, I love the tax code. When I was in law school, I would sit down with the tax code and a bottle of wine. It was a great way to spend the night. I understand we're born, we're not, you know, made. And I got to tell you, financial planning for folks with disabilities is way more complicated. You know, because of the benefits systems and the interactions in SSI and SSDI, you know, I get it. I've been there. I've done that. But here's what I'm here today to tell you. The whole point around access to assets is changing the economic expectation for people with disabilities. So what I'm going to move into now is talk about half a dozen different programs that you've probably never heard of that allow folks with disabilities to build assets. And if you put one on top of the other, on top of the other, you can get some pretty substantial change over not a very long period of time. These programs are simple, but they are not easy. It's all about information. It's all about your own expectations and taking the step to really choose to make a difference in your own life. So let's start out with benefits. Everyone here probably knows what a drag benefits can be. It's great to have an income, a stable income, but boy, they make it hard, don't they? We like to call it, you know, economic disincentives. You know, if you're on SSI, it's like, great, I get to make $20. Ooh, and then an additional $65, and then they take $1 for each. Yeah, we've all heard the equations. Well, you know what? What SSI and SSDI never tell you is there are ways around that. There are really good ways around that. People hate it when I say this, but it's kind of like a shelter. You've heard of tax shelters? There are SSI shelters. There are SSDI shelters. So that's one thing. There are special tax rules involved that I'll talk about. But really, the first order of business is to find a reliable, trustworthy place that you can go to do research on your own benefits. And at the World Institute on Disability, we have such a place. It's online. It's called DB101, as in disabilitybenefits101.org. So DB101.org. Any question you've ever had about benefits in California around any program, you can find the answer to it there. It's a great resource for educated consumers, and it's a great resource for benefits professionals. We even have calculators on there. You're thinking about going back to work, it's a part-time job, and you don't know how your benefits will be affected, we have calculators that you can use to figure that out. And then once you figure that out, that's when access to assets comes in, because we can show you how to take those resources and leverage them and really make a difference. So let's talk about some statistics. Everybody knows the employment rate for folks with disabilities and folks who are blind isn't very good. You know the poverty rate for people with disabilities is twice that of any other minority? It's over 30%. Even simple things like bank accounts. You know, the folks that are here are probably fairly exemplary, but nationwide, only 30 to 35% of people with disabilities have a checking account.
Wow.
And only 12% have a savings account. I was arguing with a good friend of mine about this back in June. And we thought, you know, we don't know anyone like that. But then we thought, you know, we know someone who might know someone like that. And we said, you know, hey, do you know anyone who doesn't have a checking account or a savings account? And she said, well, I don't. So we all know folks who are you know, suffering through this. And what happens is they wind up going to check cashing places. Yeah. The national rate, the national cost to cash a check at a check cashing agency is $40. That's a government benefits check, and they're taking $40 right off the top. And if you're working, that's twice a week or twice a month. That's $80 a month. So one of the things that we often talk about as a starting point is that you need to have a relationship with a financial institution. And even given all the fallout that, you know, we've all heard about on the news, there are still credit unions and banks and other financial institutions that really provide good services. You know, automatic deposit of a check, you know, will get you free online bill pay and a free checking account more often than not. So that's sort of the first part. But moving more into the asset building aspect of the world, all asset building programs share one thing in common. And that thing is you have to have some earned income. Now, you know, I say that at gatherings like this, and people are like, well, you know, you're talking about a full-time job. Nope, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about some earned income. That can be selling stuff on eBay. That can be babysitting. That can be helping college students write term papers. That can be part-time massage therapists, needlework that you sell to friends or on eBay. Just some sort of earned income. And I'll get to why this is so important in a couple of minutes. You know, the other part is when you do have earned income, then people start to, you know, and I've done this. It's like, well, you know, if you get paid cash, why even tell anybody about it, really? Because, you know, what's the upside, right? Income tax? Well, you know, the IRS has this organization called SPEC. It's Strategic Partnerships, Education and Communications. And I work with them a lot. And I got to say that this is a group that that everyone in here should know about for two reasons. Because they really try to make a difference for people with disabilities, and they desperately want to hire people with disabilities. And again, you know, send me an email at tom@wid.org. I can give you more information about that. But there's this thing through the IRS. It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And it's this really cool tax credit. Basically, even if you don't owe tax, you know, if you earn, say, $500 a month, and that comes out to $6,000 a year, you technically don't have to file taxes because you don't make enough. But you know what happens if you file your taxes? You're eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit. And that can be as much as $420 for a single individual. So, you know, okay, I don't owe any taxes, but I'll file my taxes, and it gets me $420. Not a lot, but it's a beginning, right? But you know what else that would have gotten you in 2008? That would have gotten you, exactly, a $600 stimulus check. Okay, so now we still haven't paid any taxes, right? But now we're up to $1,020. And, you know, that's not bad. $1,020 for filing your taxes when you really don't owe anything. And, you know, let's back up a minute. So that's $1,020, but what if you didn't have a checking account and now you do? So you're saving at least $40 a month there, so call that $500. We're up to $1,500. Good start for doing nothing, right? So, you know, one of the big things in the asset building community is a thing called an individual development account, or an IDA. Has anyone ever heard of an IDA? I know a few people probably have. Yeah, okay. So an IDA is basically a matched savings account. And again, you can only put earned income into it. And the really cool thing about it is that you receive a match. So for every dollar that you put into this account, it's sometimes matched 1-to-1, which is 100% return. You know, ask anyone involved in the stock market right now. You know, I'd be really good with, like, you know, any return, not a loss right now. But there's a 1-to-1 return with IDA programs. Often there's a 2-to-1 return. In San Francisco, there's a 3-to-1 return available right now. And if anyone wants to move to Kentucky, I know of a program with a 7-to-1 match, but you got to move to Kentucky. Anyway, so the really interesting thing about these IDA accounts is there's a couple kind, and for folks with disabilities, particularly those of whom are on benefits, you want to find a federally funded one. It's called AFIA, A-F-I-A, American Financial Independence Act. And the magical part about these federally funded IDAs is that they really provide an advantage on benefits. So let us say that you're working and you're making that $500 a month, right? We know how SSI works. First 20 you get to keep, next 65 you get to keep. But that would still, in this equation, leave $415 that SSI would look at, and they'd let you keep half of it, basically. What if you were to put that $415 into the IDA account every month? Well, then your check wouldn't change at all. For purposes of SSI and SSDI, money put into an IDA account is an income disregard. So you could earn, check this out, call it $415 you could earn. You could receive a 2-to-1 match. That would be another $830. And your check would not change at all. The match from the IDA account also doesn't count as income. So I know I'm just throwing around numbers here, and these are kind of big numbers, but the money that you earn that you put in the IDA doesn't count as a resource, neither does the match. So all of a sudden, you know, you're looking at major savings. Now these IDA programs, especially the federal ones, you know, they really want you to invest in assets. So there's basically three big savings goals. You can save for higher education, and that really varies. You know, often it can be trade school or massage school or college or, you know, something like that. You can save money to buy a home, which is usually a pretty good investment over the long haul, almost always. Or you could use it to start a small business or a micro enterprise. And those are pretty much the big three savings goals for an IDA account. But it just let's just back up again and take a look at what we've talked about thus far. You know, how do you fund the IDA? Well, you got to have earnings, right? So we've got $40 a month from getting a bank account. You know, that's a pretty good start. And then the earned income tax credit, there's another $420. You know, that's pretty good. The stimulus payment, $600. That's pretty good. What if we'd put all that, just that, into an IDA account with a 3-to-1 match? And let's say we start saving that for a home. I used to do a lot of real estate. I'm a real estate junkie. I told you I was boring. But, you know, this is real doable stuff. You know, the opening a bank account, that, you know, SSI is not going to look at that. That's not going to affect anything. The earned income tax credit, all that stuff, that went outside the realm of SSI and SSDI. So that's not going to affect your benefits in any way. And then the IDA, yet another shelter. All of a sudden, you know, if you do it right, and again, it's pretty simple, right? You just got to follow the rules, and you got to, you know, have some earned income, and you got to make the choice that you want to change, you know, the economic expectation. So, you know, depending on the numbers, it can make a difference in as little as a year or two. Let's call it 2 years, right? We've got $500 from the banking savings, $400 in the tax credit, another $600. $1,500, we take that $1,500 with a 3-to-1 match, and magically we're at $6,000 after 1 year. And SSI can't touch it. So, you know, we do that again in year two. Now we're at $12,000. And remember, this does involve earned income. And that means, you know, some sort of employment, you know, like we talked about before. And, you know, here's the magic to employment, actually. You know, you can even start volunteering. Because, you know, volunteer positions lead to part-time positions. And part-time positions lead to more part-time positions, which can lead to full-time positions, which lead to more responsibility. And all of a sudden, you're making so much money, you get to walk into Social Security and go, drop dead. Having been there, that's a really fun moment. So, you know, and it's not just the work experience, it's not just the building the resume, but it's all the connections you make along the way. You know, it's the people you meet volunteering, it's the people you meet in the part-time job, and it's the people that you meet and impress, you know, in the full-time job. But anyway, let's get back to this 12,000, because 12,000, that's a nice large number. You know, I'm from the Bay Area, where real estate is still rather pricey. And even after everything that's happened, you pretty much, if you want something in a nice area, you're looking at a condo at around $400,000. That's a lot of money for somebody who might be just working part-time or something like that. But, you know, especially in California, we're really blessed in California. We have some pretty good policy people here and some pretty good policies when it comes to building building assets. I'm trying to discreetly check the time, and I'm failing completely, so I beg your pardon. Anyway, so you got a $400,000 piece of property. Well, you know, in San Francisco and in Oakland, I'll start with Oakland. First-time home buyer programs, you know, there is $50,000 right off the bat that anyone with a disability can qualify for. In specific parts of Oakland, there's another 25 in down payment assistance. They just sort of kick in. When you eventually sell the house, you know, you have to pay it back. But that's not bad, right? We just knocked 400 down to 325 in about 30 seconds. But you got to know about these programs. You have to know that they're out there. You have to have access to the information. So, you know, so that's not bad. But you still have to make the monthly payment, right? You know, probably we all know some folks who are on Section 8, you know, have the Section 8 voucher. You know, you can use a Section 8 voucher to pay a mortgage. Yeah, isn't that kind of an interesting piece of information that, you know, I wish I had known about 25 years ago? So that's pretty cool. But, you know, the other thing they have specifically in California, it was suspended for a while, but it is on its way back, is specifically for folks with disabilities who want to buy their first home. It's a 4% 30-year fixed mortgage. So right now, $100,000 would cost about $700 a month with a traditional mortgage. With this mortgage, it goes down to about $450, $500. So that's a $200,000 mortgage for about $1,000. Okay, so we're a lot closer, aren't we? And, you know, maybe there's a Section 8 voucher worth $1,000. Well, there's, you know, so anyway, again, there are all these programs. And standing alone, you know, the EITC, $420, big deal. But, you know, you put that into an IDA that is designed for home ownership, and at the end of 2 years, you have $12,000. All these programs require some down payment, usually about $5,000, but you've got $12,000 in your IDA specifically set aside for this. And then you sign up for the 4% mortgage and you know, the first-time home buyers program. In San Francisco, first-time home buyers with disabilities, up to $150,000 in down payment assistance and mortgage forgiveness. You know, that's real money, folks. There are lots of programs out there like this, trying to help folks with disabilities, working folks with disabilities, to build assets and really change their economic future. I've been with WID for about 18 months now, and we do this chat all over the country. And programs differ from place to place, but California particularly is a great place to do this stuff. You know, the other thing that California offers along these lines is our buy-in program here in California, the Medicaid program, because everyone needs health insurance, and, you know, God willing, there'll be a change in D.C. soon. Everyone get out and vote, please. You know, the movement, Nothing About Us Without Us. If you can't vote, if you don't vote, you don't get to complain. The Medicaid buy-in program, we all need Medicaid. In California, you can get full-scope Medi-Cal, even if you're making up to $53,000 a year on the Medicaid buy-in program. And you know what else that program does? Is it allows you to set money aside in a 401k or a 403b or a Roth or so, you know, when we do these things, you know, we could have someone on SSI who starts out, you know, volunteering, making a little bit of money, you know, puts money into an IDA, gets an EITC, 420, puts that into the IDA. After a couple of years, they've got enough money for a down payment on a house. And after a couple of years, they've got a little bit better job. And, you know, maybe they're even putting money into a retirement account because they're on the Medicaid buy-in program, the Medi-Cal 250 program. Getting back to that whole banking the unbanked, you know that $40 every 2 weeks that could be going to the payday lenders? If you put that into a retirement account, over only 30 years, the Brookings Institute came out with the number, $380,000. So we're not changing a lot here, right? You know, we're working a little bit, but we know what we're doing. We have a plan. It's pretty simple. Again, simple, but not easy. But, you know, at the end of the 30 years, you own a house. You have several hundred thousand dollars in savings. You know, this is what is possible when you have the access to the information and you want to change your own economic expectation for you and your family and your life. You know, there are other asset building tools that are out there. There are special needs trusts that we can talk about, you know, perhaps another time. But I did want to make sure that I leave a little bit of time for questions because this is complicated stuff. But, you know, again, it's simple steps that we as consumers have to choose to make to really change the economic expectations for folks with disabilities. Anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. For the folks online, tom@wid.org, tom@wid.org. Tom, my email address is tom@wid.org.
Tom, thank you for a really, really upbeat presentation. We have time for maybe two or three questions only, but who would like to ask one?
I do.
Please give your name.
My name is Isabel Ibarra, and I'm from Whittier, and I had a question regarding the Medicaid program. Do you have to have Social Security to enlist in the Medicaid program?
No.
How do you do it?
You talk to me afterwards, and I can direct you to how to go about doing that.
Thank you.
Tom, T-O-M, at W-I-D, no, World Institute Disability, W-I-D.org.
Okay, my name is Artis Bazin, and I wanted to ask you, is most of this information on your website?
A great deal of it is. Our website is www.wid.org. And again, the name of my particular program is Access to Assets. But the DB 101 link is on that page as well.
Tom, I've got a question for you.
Sir.
I know you spend a lot of time speaking and traveling and so forth. Is WID or you through WID able to actually provide any personal counseling to people?
We have an online newsletter that
right.
does a little bit about that called Equity.
Right.
And again, if you send me an email, we can sign up for that. We work with various states and large organizations, you know, doing what I'm doing here tonight. I do a little bit of sort of one-on-one stuff,
sure,
but it's mostly
sure.
just referrals.
So the website really is a key.
Yeah, the website is definitely a key, and I encourage everyone to sign up for our newsletter as well.
Fantastic. Anybody else?
I had a question. My name is Joel. I came in a little late, but could you explain the different types of IDAs? Maybe not in any detail, but just quickly.
If someone's on benefits, you probably want to get into a federally funded one because that will get you around the income and asset disregards. The main savings goals for IDAs are to buy a house, to start a small business, or to go back to school for further education. There are more flexible ones that are funded privately and by the states. You run into some benefit issues. There are ways around that as well, and they have more flexible purchasing options.
I'm Jacqueline Jackson. When you, I
don't know if I heard you correctly, that you could use a Section 8 voucher to pay your mortgage and you could make $50,000? Did you say that?
Two different issues. Yes, you can use a Section 8 voucher to make mortgage payments.
Mm-hmm.
And the separate topic, the Medicaid buy-in program in California, you can make up to $53,000 and still be on it.
Okay. Will your equity be counted against you? Like, I have $400,000 worth of equity
no.
in my home.
No, it's an unrealized gain.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you.
Okay, one more.
Hi, I'm Sharon Watson. I just had a question about the flexible IDAs that you were just talking about.
Yes.
They do not have to be used to purchase a home or a school education or
no, you know,
small business?
All the IDA programs have different rules. You know, there are residency rules. There are income rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're making $100,000 a year, you're not going to qualify for an IDA.
Oh.
But they will have the particular program will determine what they fund. So it might be technology, so you can go back mm-hmm. to work. It might be a car, so you can go back to work. Each program's a little different,
mm-hmm.
and I forgot to include this earlier, but I'll do it now. For a pretty comprehensive list of national IDA programs,
mm-hmm.
www.idanetwork.org.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tom Foley, thank you so much. You know, it's rare to have somebody on the program that I know. I don't think I've had this happen in the last 3 years. And it's even more rare to have somebody that I know, but realize today I didn't know a whole lot about what he did professionally. So it's a great, great treat to have you, and we may just have to have you back and tell us more. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker is Christian Wild. He's an author and researcher of two groundbreaking books and the Christian Wild Stem Cell Research Report that introduces stem cell breakthroughs showing promise in the treatment of more than 70 major diseases. His books, Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke, and his newest book, Miracle Stem Cell Heart Repair, have been enthusiastically endorsed by directors of cardiology at 5 major universities. John Rumberger, MD, PhD, formerly of the Mayo Clinic and Ohio State University, said, quote, "Until this book, a reliable resource for the patient, was simply not available, as the subject is vast and complicated." Our speaker today is a repeat guest on more than 200 radio and TV shows and a favorite guest on George Nuri's Coast to Coast AM. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in giving a warm welcome to author, researcher, Christian Wild.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When I received the invitation to address you this morning from Jean, I responded immediately. I have enormous respect for the way you deal with everyday challenges in your life. And I'm very happy to be here. There's another reason, too, why I wanted to be here. And that is because I've often wondered what would happen if I were to yell, "Here, kitty, kitty, kitty," in a room like this. But there is going to be some information I want to share with you, even for our four-legged friends, because stem cells right now are also being used to treat animal diseases. I had my dog for 19 years, and I understand. Let me take you back to what started me in this whole research and writing project. Heart disease, of course, is the number one killer of Americans. And many years ago, I had just finished my annual physical. My doctor said, "Christian, your thallium treadmill, your nuclear treadmill is fantastic. The results are great. Your cholesterol is exemplary. Your blood work is right." He said, "I don't need to see you for another year." He said, "Now go on, get out of here." And I started to leave, and I turned, and I said, you know, Doc, just out of curiosity, can I ask you a question? I said, how many times do physicians tell the patient that they are in perfect health, and they go on their way, and then you hear maybe a week later or 3 days later that the gentleman kneeled over at the fourth hole of the golf course and had a massive coronary? Mm-hmm. Or how about somebody else's wife that went to sleep one night and didn't wake up in the morning? And he said, that happens far too often. He said, you know, we physicians are in the business of saving lives. And when things like this happen and situations like this arise, it's devastating to us as well as the caretakers. And I started to leave, and he said, oh, one thing I want you to take with you. He said, I don't know if you're aware of this. He said, all of the cholesterol information and the testing we do is vitally important. He said, but I don't know if you're aware that 50% of all the heart attacks that happen in this country happen to people with normal cholesterol. And I left. About a week later, I'm watching television, and one of the most respected physically enthusiastic or super examples of physical health dropped dead while he was running. And we've all heard of situations like that. Well, I wanted to find out what there might be out there in the research community. What might be escaping physicians? Because you know the research community is 15 to 20 years ahead of the practicing physician's office. And I figured that's a long time to wait, and a lot of people will die in the interim. So I started the research project. I did not know it would take 5 years. And the reason it did is because if I was going to validate and make claims, I'd better have my ducks in order. Consequently, the book had 17 pages of bibliography. And when it came out, I didn't know this could possibly happen, but the directors of these major universities in preventive cardiology validated enthusiastically and endorsed the book. There is so much out there. And my real interest wasn't just in detecting and finding these hidden causes, because that's the name of the book, Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke. But finding the problem alone was not the real challenge. What good does it do to point out a problem if you can't offer a solution? So there is why it took the 5 years. It's like saying to somebody, you know, you've got a blemish on the side of your face there. And the person says, well, I know I've got one. It didn't do any good. It was negative to bring it up. But if you could say to the person, you got a blemish on the side of your face, but you know, there is a new cream that came out last week. And if you apply it 3 times a day for a week, that blemish will disappear and there will be no scar. Now, that would be something positive to offer somebody.
Exactly.
As I went along, I started to encounter people who would contact me and say, the preventive information in the book, particularly on inflammation, because the subtitle was Inflammation, Cardiology's Newest Frontier. And to my knowledge, this was the first time the general public was really hearing about inflammation. And they were saying that the preventive information was arriving very late in their own disease process. These are people who have had 3 and possibly 4 heart attacks. They were in advanced 3rd or 4th stage heart failure. And they said, what is there out there for us? And I started to do a little research in that area. I learned that Dr. Doris Taylor, on faculty at Duke University, had just recently published a paper in which she took a dog. Fellas, if you want to cover your ears with your paws for a second, I'll tell you the story. But it has a good ending, so it's okay. So they had taken a dog and induced a heart attack in the animal, and then harvested stem cells from the leg of that dog, and she injected them into the myocardium, the heart itself, the damaged areas, and for the first time in the history of medicine, a heart was rejuvenated. Immediately, that information started to spread. I don't know how many of you listen to Coast AM. Well, I want to bring you a, first of all, I forgot to tell you, I'm bringing you a warm welcome, a greeting from George Noory.
Hey. Well,
and he cares about all of us. Anyway, George was interviewing myself and Dr. Warren Sherman, who is a is the world leader in stem cell research for the heart. He is the director at Columbia University in endovascular and cardiovascular stem cell therapies. Dr. Sherman traveled to the Netherlands to perform the first myoblast stem cell transplant into a human being. Shortly after that, a fellow by the name of Jose Ramirez, you may have heard George interview Jose with me on the show, but Jose Ramirez was 34 years old, had had four heart attacks, had 11 stents in his coronary arteries. He had very few options left. Dr. Sherman harvested stem cells from Jose's thigh muscle, injected them into his heart, and today, 5 years later, he doesn't ever think about his heart. He's seen his grandchildren graduate. He's still driving truck.
Oh, geez.
These are the kind of things I'm anxious to share with you. I wanted to see one of these procedures, so I flew into the Arizona Heart Institute, and Dr. Nabil Deeb performed the procedure. It was very similar to what you would see or expect in the typical angioplasty. So there are miracles happening all around us. I want to tell you about a young lady with spinal injury. Her name is Laura. She's traveling in her car in the back seat with her brother driving. They hit an oil slick. They have a tremendous accident. When the paramedics arrive, Laura is concerned and doesn't understand why her head is lying on her shoulder. She soon learns that she's a quadriplegic. Her doctors tell her there is no hope for you. Don't ever think you'll ever walk again. And they tell her father that. And he's not buying it. He said, I've heard about a Dr. Carlos Lima in Lisbon, Portugal. And I keep in touch with Dr. Lima because I'm really impressed with what he's doing for people. So Dr. Lima harvested stem cells that are called olfactory stem cells. They're above the nose, the bridge of the nose, below the brain. Harvested those stem cells and injected them into the spinal lesion of her sixth vertebrae that had literally burst open. Laura explained to us that it wasn't very long afterward she knew something was happening. Well, of course, you wonder if it's a placebo effect at first. But I saw the MRIs before and after. At 3 months, the lesion was totally healed. Laura began walking. With the aid of, and this is also exciting because we're going to talk about some possibilities for vision disease also. But she put away her walker. She got rid of her leg braces. And the last time we talked, which was on the show, she was down to her ankle braces and expected to shake those very soon. Laura also appeared before the subcommittee in Washington, D.C., in Congress, as one of the individuals to talk about adult stem cells and how they have affected her life. There's another gentleman by the name of Dennis Turner. And he also appeared before the subcommittee. Now, Dennis had all symptoms, advanced symptoms of Parkinson's. Dr. Michelle Levesque at UCLA, director of neurosurgery, had harvested stem cells from Mr. Turner's brain and multiplied them and then injected them back into the brain, and all symptoms of Parkinson's totally disappeared for 4 years. And then they started to creep back in. Now, that would mean he would have to be redosed again, but it also means that as we make more progress in this, they determine the number of cells they should be using. So that's what's going on in the FDA trials right now. There are about 1,600 trials going on, in case you wonder what's being done with stem cells. they can't talk much about it until they announce their results. I will tell you that the trial I mentioned to you before for the heart, for heart failure, if any of you encounter that or have any family members, I want you to know that there was an 83% success rate on the first phase of the trial, which is incredible. 17% remained the same or got a little bit worse, but nobody died. The FDA, encouraged by those figures, has now opened that trial to 450 more patients in 35 centers across the country. It was a gentleman that I have in the book. Incidentally, the name of that book became Miracle Stem Cell Heart Repair. And one of the gentlemen in the book, is a doctor told him in Arizona, he said, Joe, I don't know how the hell you're still alive. He said, you know, 75% of your heart is dead tissue here. And he said, I'll tell you what, there's a study being done at the Arizona Heart Institute. If you want me to, I'll set you up an appointment. Joe said I had nothing to lose. He went over, and Dr. Deeb and Dr. Dietrich made him one of their first patients, injected his own stem cells into his heart, and that's been almost 4 years, and he is doing just as well. These are patients who could not negotiate a walk from the living room to the bathroom without being totally exhausted. And within one, they go home the second day, they keep them there for observation, and within 6 weeks they're walking a mile a day. These aren't just a few people. These are people that I have met and documented, and they are in the FDA trial, so you know it's very legitimate. Knowing I would be speaking with you today, I made a few phone calls to people that I have contacted in the past, a couple of them for sure. I knew that retinitis pigmentosa, there was going to be a study with stem cells, adult stem cells, at the KCI Institute. Is anybody interested in that one?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I contacted Dr. Francis. He gave me a long interview, and I said, I'm going to be speaking to a special group of people this weekend. Is there anything you could tell me to give a little hope? He said, we're very excited about what we're going to be doing. I said, I thought that trial was to begin already. And he said, we've had funding problems. I said, can you give me a target date? I don't mean to nail you down, but can you give me a target date I can share with the people? He said, mid-2009. And now I pushed him a little further. I said, so that these people can know whether they and their physicians want to be in this trial, is it possible that you could pre-qualify them and put them on the list? He said, yes, we could do that.
Wow.
So he said they could either come here to the KCI Institute in Portland, that we can evaluate them. And then he said, you know, it's possible that we could have them evaluated with certain doctors in California. And if they qualify, then they would be in the trial. Macular degeneration. I have it in my family. My mother had it. My sisters have it. I have dry. So naturally, I'm concerned about macular degeneration. He's starting the trial about the same time. So if anybody wants to be involved. Of course, you know that from a pharmaceutical standpoint, the two shots that they're using, the VEGF shots, are Lucentis and Avastin. Both of those have been effective, pardon me, in stopping the bleeding in wet macular degeneration if you catch it early. There is also, and these things that I share with you, I'm not a doctor, so I can't recommend them. I can only bring you the information, and then you and your families and your doctors can decide whether you want to look into them or not. Of all the companies or hospitals outside of the United States, and incidentally, they're treating diabetes 1 and diabetes 2 with one shot of bone marrow stem cells, your own cells, no rejection, into the pancreas, and the pancreas immediately starts to produce its own insulin. They're doing it for type 1. They're doing it for type 2. Now, some of these facilities I don't know a lot about, but the ones that I do know have real strong reputations. I asked the one in Beijing, China, if they would send me some information on a disease that many of you are familiar with, optic nerve hypoplasia. And CNN, he sent me an interview on CNN of a young girl whose parents took her to China to have 7 injections of umbilical cord stem cells, which are adult stem cells. After having the 4th injection, her mother explains on the CNN interview that they were standing in the elevator that had mirrors in it, and the little girl said, as she saw herself in the mirror, didn't realize it, and said, "Hi." Those are some of the good things that I wanted to share with you. And, of course, for animals, they are doing stem cells. They're certified stem cell vets in the area that have had great results with dysplasia and bone and tendon diseases among animals. So, Pooches, if you're listening to me, listen up. There's an MS trial going on in Ottawa that shows great promise. Basically, what they're doing is stripping the body of the stem cells, similarly to how they use chemotherapy, and then re-injecting fresh stem cells, and the MS symptoms are disappearing. I think the best they've done is 3.5 years, still haven't had any problems. I don't know if you've heard me on the show, but we talk an awful lot about turmeric, the spice from India.
Yeah.
Well, we cleaned out turmeric from stores all over the country. George got an email. He passed it on to me. A woman who has a health food store in Utah said she was sold out immediately, and all the stores in the area had contacted her, said, "Do you have any extra turmeric curcumin?" It's being found that this spice that comes out of India for 2,500 years has caused that country to have the lowest incidence of prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer of any place in the world, and also the lowest accounting for dementia and Alzheimer's, all due to the spice turmeric. And you're going to hear more and more about it. I didn't mention to you that I had also contacted the Doheny Eye Clinic Thursday. I talked to a Miss Douglas who's in charge of their trials. They are not doing any stem cell trials, but they are doing a pharmaceutical study for uveitis. Is that how you pronounce it? Uveitis. So if anybody has any interest in looking into that, it's the Doheny Eye Clinic, very well respected. And the coordinator is Miss Douglas. There is something you probably are wondering, most people are, and that is, what's the difference between embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells? There are problems with embryonic stem cells. When I came to this study, I had no agenda. I would report it either way. The world leader in stem cell research is Dr. Ian Wilmot from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He's the actual scientist who cloned Dolly the sheep. See, I said sheep, and look at all those dogs jump up. So Dr. Wilmot made a statement to the scientific community last November that absolutely shook the scientific world. He said, "I no longer will pursue embryonic stem cell research." And it wasn't because of a moral or ethical reasoning that he made that decision. It was based purely on scientific principle. He said, "We have a better way to do this with adult cells." And he said he would start to use skin cells. And already there's a breakthrough they're talking about with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, using adult stem cells from the skin. The problems with embryonic stem cells, and the best way that I can relate it to you, is to use Dr. Lima's speech before the Parliament in the United Kingdom, in which he made everyone aware that it is true that the United States and Great Britain have limited funding for embryonic research. But he said, keep in mind, it has gone on unfettered in every other country in the world, including Germany, China, Israel, and France. And he said, still there is not one reported, documented, successful treatment with an embryonic stem cell. And the reasons are twofold. Number one, the body rejects it. Number two, which is the major concern scientifically, you cannot put an embryonic stem cell or any stem cell into the human body until you find it first safe to do so in an animal study. They have never been able to do that. What has happened is the embryonic stem cells have created tumors throughout the body. I thought I'd share that with you. Maybe they'll overcome that. The main concern is that they find cures for catastrophic diseases. This is just an opinion from an old, tired writer who loves dogs. Let me share this with you. I believe that every disease will be conquered, and I don't think it's that far off. Another suggestion, if I might make, if any of you are having children or you have family members who are having children, you might want to encourage them to cryogenically freeze the umbilical cord. Because as childhood diseases show up in the fifth year and the 12th year, whatever, if they have the cord, they can, by that time, have a cure that they can extract cells from that cord. I'll give you an example. Dr. Crutzberg, a leading pediatrician and researcher at Duke University, was brought a young boy of 5 years of age whose parents just happened to have frozen his umbilical cord. He had cerebral palsy. In a 20-minute procedure, once she harvested the cells from the cord, injected into this little boy, 8 months later, declared completely free of cerebral palsy. And the main thing is I wanted to bring you this hope. There is one other story that I cannot totally confirm at this point, and that is a doctor from India traveled to these friends that I keep in contact with at the hospital in Beijing for retinitis pigmentosa treatment. The report was that he had great benefit and was beginning to see. I still haven't gotten back more confirmation. So I should probably, just to give you a little hope, but I don't have that confirmation. But the hospital told me that he was doing exceptionally well. They were amazed at the results. I guess you're going to have some questions. Okay.
Ready for questions? Okay, we're ready for questions. If you want to raise your hand or stand, we'll bring you a mic.
Yeah, do you know if they're doing any research for those of us who have glaucoma?
Yes, they are.
Where?
They are doing research for glaucoma.
Where? Doheny?
I can give you. I looked them up the other day, and I didn't get to them to talk to them. But I'd be happy to forward that information to you.
Please. I definitely would love to get a hold of that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Glenda Castle.
Glenda Castle, is that right? Okay.
Glenda Castle, San Diego Castle.
All right.
Hello, my name's Foster Brown.
How are you, Foster?
I'm doing well. In the story you mentioned about the young lady whose spine had got severed and they injected the stem cells, that also healed the nerve endings too? It actually put the spine back together?
It puts the spine back together. The muscles have to be retrained.
But
it's kind of an arduous rehab. It takes several months afterward. And the younger people do better because they have more stamina.
But the what I'm interested in was the spinal cord itself.
Yes, severed cord is healed.
Wow. Okay. All right. And one last question.
Go ahead.
When you mentioned about the freezing of the umbilical cord,
yes.
What about the placenta as well?
I don't know I don't know that they care about the placenta. They probably get what they need in the cord.
In the cord.
And
okay.
There's banks everywhere that you can do that.
All right. Thank you.
My name is Lewis Preston. And you said some magic words today that I don't hear very often. The first magic word was uveitis. And the second was Doheny Eye Clinic.
Okay.
Because that's where I had surgery for uveitis done about 1985.
Wow.
Now, you mentioned a Mrs. Douglas.
Yeah, she's the coordinator.
She's the coordinator. So if I want more information about what she's doing, all I do is call Doheny.
Eye Institute and tell her that you're interested in wondering if you would qualify, having had surgery, if you would qualify for the trial on uveitis.
Okay. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, sir.
Hi, my name is Pete Romero. I'm curious to know whether there's any research being done for people who have what used to be called RLF, and I guess it's now called ROP. Thank you.
I must tell you, I'm not familiar with that. I'm sorry.
Retinopathy premature.
You're talking about retinopathy?
Yeah.
Diabetic neuropathy?
No, it's premature. And
how many of you are concerned with that?
Yeah.
Most of us, probably.
Wow. Or a lot of us.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to be happy to spend some time seeing what I can find out for you and pointing you to those centers.
Thank you.
Oh, I just asked, how do we get in touch with you? Is there a phone number?
Well, let me give you an email.
I don't do email.
Okay. Take this number, 866-STEM, S-T-E-M, 123. Give me a few days to get back to you. That last Nuri show we did, we had over 1,300 phone calls, and my staff is answering as many as we can. ASCAP, A-S-C-A-P, ASCAP, at PacBell, PACBELL.net. Yes, ASCAP, A-S-C-A-P. At PacBell.net.
Hi, I'm Patricia Wolf, and I'm particularly interested in what you were saying about diabetes. I've been diabetic type 1 for 64 years.
Wow.
And I have read some articles about how they have been injecting the stem cells, and it's been making the pancreas produce more insulin, but that's mostly happening, isn't it, with people who are newly diagnosed?
No. And as far as the heart trials, I meant to say earlier, these people could have had their heart attacks 20 years ago, and in their cases, it doesn't make any difference. Type 1 diabetes, your specific question was they're only doing it in young people?
Yeah, with newly diagnosed. Not necessarily young, but newly diagnosed.
Maybe that particular trial, but others are not.
Okay.
They tend to like to use younger people in most trials because they are stronger, their bodies are stronger, and if they're trying to prove a proof of concept on a new study or a new breakthrough, they tend to have better results with the youngest patients.
Okay, now. Do you have an email letter or somewhere you could, or get on the list to sign up, or as well send it to people in print?
I have, yes, I have the Christian Weill Stem Cell Research Report, in which I report on breakthroughs with all diseases. We're dealing with breast cancer and
also the name of your book?
Pardon, the name of the book?
Yeah.
First book is Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke. The second book is Miracle Stem Cell Heart Repair. They're on the website. I didn't give you the website. The website is www. myheartbook, and that's one word, .com. You need the W's because somebody else picked up myheartbook.com. They stole it right out from under me.
Okay,
so www.myheartbook.com. The books are there. The newsletter is there.
My question, my name is Bill Powers. My question is there any research that is currently being done on people who were born with rubella?
I'd have to look that up. You understand, most of my concentration has been on cardiovascular. But because I was going to be speaking with you today, I wanted to do that.
Right. Rubella is a kind of a combination disease because it involves the eyes, it involves the ears, and it involves heart disease.
That's right.
Hi, my name is Isabel Ibarra, and I have a rare form of a syndrome called VKH. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's very rare. Is there any stems? It's called Vogt Koyanagi-Harada syndrome.
I'm going to suggest that you, that's okay.
Is there any stem cell research?
I want you to go through clinicaltrials.gov.
Clinicaltrials.gov.
And put in what you're looking for, have somebody do it with you, and search for the name of the disease and stem cells and see anywhere if they're doing it.
And,
Ace, that's good. Thank you, Ace.
And then
that's
the second question is the umbilical cord, does it have to be your own umbilical cord?
Your own umbilical cord. However, okay. If they have to take cells from other umbilical cords, they do that also. But as far as you being concerned with your own children, ideally their own stem cells is what you want to, for your grandchildren too, you know, that are being born today.
I have one more.
My name is Norma Guerrero, and I'm a member of the Capital Chapter of the CCB. And I've been wrestling with this. I'm a delegate, and I'm taking notes to take back to our chapter, which forced me to be here today and for your talk. And
I'm glad
I say that because I'm Catholic, and we have been schooled it as far as stem cell research to say no, 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 no. But in hearing you speak and listening to the miraculous things they're doing now with stem cell research, I'm very interested to hear exactly what you mean by harvesting. I want to get rid of that bugaboo that and I want to make sure that I stay objective in my reporting.
Let me answer your deepest concerns. There is no reason many of the world leaders will tell you that they need to use the embryonic cell, because everything that they said would be done with the embryonic can be done with an adult stem cell.
Yes.
So when you hear about anything, it's an adult stem cell. I'm amazed, for instance, a year ago, it made an international news. Someday, they said, we will be able to heal the spinal injury in a mouse using an embryonic stem cell.
Mm-hmm.
That got front page news.
Right.
And I'm pulling my hair out, but I don't have any hair. You can't see it, but I don't have any hair. So, you see, it was safe to tell you that. I'm saying, what? There are 150 patients done by Dr. Lima alone.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you talk to them? Why don't you interview them?
Mm-hmm.
And how many of these people have you, with the heart, total restoration of their hearts, have you heard about?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, I talk to them every day. I've met them. And the media doesn't seem to want to cover it. They don't want to talk to them. They have a dog in the fight. There's that word again.
Well, I thank you for clearing that up. I just wanted to be sure that I remain objective
right. In
reporting this back to my chapter, and that I also get rid of my own prejudice regarding this area because of all the wonderful things that are being done.
That's right.
Thank you.
Mr. Weil, I want to, if I could, clear up a few loose ends. We may have time for one or two
sure.
more questions. One loose end that occurs to me You mentioned about the type 1 and type 2 diabetes research. Is that all in clinical trials at this time?
It's no. If a person wanted to travel to Argentina,
right,
they could have it done. They could have it done in the United Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And there are places, you know, they talk about a couple of things that can help you with diabetes. It is a vascular disease. Unfortunately, if you have diabetes, you really have heart disease. You might have heard that before. The president of the Diabetic Association, American Diabetic Association, said, "I'm amazed that people aren't aware that the two are connected at the hip." Mm. But you've heard, maybe you've heard that you can add a spoonful of cinnamon,
yep,
to your food each morning or whatever, and there's some benefit from it. The advice, of course, and you've heard it before, is try to get a little exercise, control the weight, stay away from white flours and anything white. And those are minor things. Of course, a lot of people do very well with glucophage and medications. But, you know, it is a tough disease. Yeah. Hopefully, to really answer your question, hopefully, there are trials going on, and hopefully it won't take that long before you can get help from your own physician in treating any of these diseases.
Thank you. And in the title presentation, it implied that you might have something to say about potential repair for people who have suffered from strokes.
Yes. There is some stem cell treatment being done right now. Also, the hyperbaric chamber has shown some results. But there are studies in progress right now. There's even studies for meniscus muscle. All of it we cover in the newsletter. And it's something that just fascinates me, because I'll look at every morning. I get reports from all over the world, mm-hmm, on breakthroughs on any number of diseases. I don't think there's anything you could mention, except you did come up with one or two, but I'm going to look into those. You stumped me. You knew I was coming, and you said, "I'm going to nail him." No, I'm going to be happy to look into those.
All right. How about one or two more questions?
Go ahead.
I know we're over a little bit, but I also know how exciting this is for folks.
Yeah, I'm Larry Freeman from the
Hi, Larry.
San Diego chapter. And I just want to say blessings to you for all the work that you are doing. And I can see why the adult stem cell research would make a lot more sense than the other, because they're fully developed.
That's right.
Now, I want to be sure I have that number right. 866-STEM-123?
You've got it.
Great.
And give me a few days.
All right.
Website is www.myheartbook.com. I have had many people contact me from the radio shows that I've done with George. He's been very gracious to me. I appreciate his friendship. And I try to get back to everybody I can and offer some information, even if I don't have it at the time. If I can do it, I'll look at, you know, I'll get around to it, and I'll try to give you something. Yes, sir.
Yes, Bob Young from the East LA chapter.
Hey, Bob.
Will you be back with George soon and on the show again?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I'll be sitting there watching television, and producer Tom will call me and say, "Can you go on in 30 minutes? What are we talking about?" He wants to talk about hemorrhagic stroke. Okay. Last week, he called and said, I forget what was it last week. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I've been on an awful lot of times. It kind of amazes me. One time, he said, "You're going to be on for 4 hours. 4 hours? Another time it was 3 hours, but I really enjoy it, and he's doing a lot of nice things for a lot of people. Keep listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a real warm applause to Christian Wild.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Is Tony up here?
Is Tony up here in the front? Now, we, many of us are affected, and probably all of us have been affected in our lives by vocational rehabilitation. CCB cared enough about this area to be one of the major workers on SB 105. And while I don't have a lengthy bio sketch for our next speaker, I'll just say a few personal things. I met Tony some years ago. He was working for a different agency at that time, different organization, doing a video on successful employment outcomes for employers. And I'd never met Tony before, but he came, and for a blind guy, he participated quite a lot in that video, I gotta say. He is well known to the Bay Area as a former employee of the American Foundation for the Blind Center. He's worked in rehabilitation on the East Coast at previous times, and we're very, very lucky to have him here. He is the Deputy Director of Specialized Services Division, Department of Rehabilitation in Sacramento, to give us an update today on activities related to rehabilitation for the blind. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Tony Candela.
Thanks, Chris. See, rehabilitation is the service that everyone loves to hate. First of all, I bring greetings from my director, another Tony, Mr. Tony Sauer, S-A-U-E-R, who is on assignment in Saipan in the Northern Marianas right now, and trying to impart to the folks out there some of the ways that that we do rehabilitation back here. I would venture to say he's going to encounter some of the same cultural differences between standardized rehabilitation practices here in the United States and especially in California and what they might find to be normal and comfortable out there in all those islands, as perhaps he does when he talks to me about rehabilitation of the blind and visually impaired. Because we and our needs and us, although we have many similarities with other folks with disabilities, also have our own special needs. That's why I have the job that I have. That's why I head up the division that I head up, which is the Specialized Services Division. Because folks such as yourselves helped get a law passed back in 2003 called SB 105 to enable that Specialized Services Division to be installed into the Department of Rehabilitation in such a way that it would take another act of legislation to ever make it go away. And so this was a great victory for all of us for two reasons. One, we got the structure of the Department of Rehabilitation altered a little bit. The other one was it took the effort of the combined blindness community, both consumer organizations, service providers, other interested parties, to actually get that law pushed through. And I heard Dan Kaiser say something yesterday about a different piece of legislation, and he said it was the toughest fight he'd had since SB 105, and that was a tough fight back then. And you know, Dan was part of that whole group, and you know, the mover and shaker of this organization for that movement isn't here with us today, but she's back up north, Kathy Skivers, and she deserves a hand even when she's not here. I work with Kathy. She's the chair of my Blindness Advisory Committee, and relishes the once a quarter get-togethers that we have. If for no other reason, she gets to give me a hard time. That's good. I love her. Let me tell you a little bit about the Department of Rehabilitation, what it does, where it is at these days, because you need to know that to understand a whole lot of what you have been experiencing, and what I have on some authority might even come my way in a form of a few resolutions about how blindness rehabilitation is going here in the state. You know, vocational rehabilitation, it's a very old program. Main mission, help people with disabilities to get to work, federally funded, state matching funds. That's very important, federally funded, but 78% of the money comes from the feds and 22% of the money comes from the states. That's very important for what I'm going to tell you later on, to remember that there's a state matching requirement. Department of Rehabilitation is a huge organization. It's the biggest in the country. At any one time, we have something along the lines of 2,300 employees spread around this entire state. There are anywhere between 75 and 80,000 active consumer cases going on at any one time in the organization. And of those 75 to 80,000 that are going on at any one time in the organization, maybe around 5,000 are blind and visually impaired people. So you see where we sit in that larger organization? We're a little guy in there. However undaunted, we march on. Let me tell you a little bit about the budget. You have a sense of the scale. You have a sense of where we sit in that scale of things. Let me tell you a little bit about the budget. Not the actual, you know, millions of dollars that we have to spend, but what's going on in the state of California. As you know, we are in budgetary difficulties these days. And whenever we have these statewide budgetary difficulties, the government tends to be the first one they hit upon to recoup some of the budget back, to get rid of some of the deficit. And then after they've done that, then they start cutting services to people out there in the community. And that's when politicians start getting nervous. But these two things go hand in hand. What they do to the government and what they do to you sometimes is interlocked. You can't separate them. Which is why whenever we get in trouble, we hope that our friends out there in the consumer organization communities, in the service provider communities, help us in government to do sometimes what we can't do from the inside, which is to advocate for ourselves. There was mention made yesterday by one of the presenters about how sometimes external activity is just what an internal government organization needs to be able to help itself along, because government is limited in what it can do to advocate for itself from within. We all work for the governor. So you need to understand that, too. Right now, the budget is being shrunk. They've shrunk us twice already in the last 6 months. They are shrinking us again, even as we speak. This time, the way we're going to save money is to start cutting staff in Sacramento. We vowed we're not cutting staff in the field. We're going to cut staff in Sacramento. I have my X percent of the money that I have to save by not firing anybody or laying anybody off, but by not hiring into some empty positions I have. And that's going to be a tough choice for me. What do I hire into and what do I not hire into? It's going to be really hard. But that's how we're doing it now. You will have heard of the concept called order of selection. Order of selection was something that was introduced into the rehabilitation law back in the 1990s. It was basically said if a state agency cannot afford to serve everybody who would normally be found eligible for services for the vocational rehabilitation service, if it cannot afford to serve everybody, and it can document same to the federal government, then it has to go into what they call an order of selection, and it literally says we divide the potential consumer base into three categories, 1, 2, and 3. Category 1 are the most severely disabled. Category 2 are severely disabled. And Category 3 are significantly disabled. think I've got that right. Anyways, we went into an order of selection, Department of Rehabilitation, way back in, I think it was 1992, 1993, somewhere in there. So we cut out Category 3. So now we serve the most severely disabled and the severely disabled, and we don't serve the significantly disabled. If we were asked to do that again, to decide that we were going to cut out another category, we would probably not cut out just one category. We probably would cut them both out and say we're just going to stop bringing in new consumers for a certain amount of time until we recover from the budgetary crunch that we're in. The reason for that is to cut out the second category is about as financially paralyzing and devastating as cutting them both out. We wouldn't be able to function the way our budget is set up if we cut out the second category because it actually contains the bulk of the consumer base. With the most severely disabled, the first category, which is what most of us are in, blind, visually impaired folks, being actually a smaller chunk of the consumer base. So these are some of the very weighty and heavy decisions that we hope that we'll never actually have to execute on. This latest one being, what will we do if we were pressed so hard that we had to look at the order of selection again? But this is the way things are right now. And we who are in Sacramento work very, very hard to do as little as possible to stop consumers from coming into our service and to do as little as possible to cut out or cut down on the amounts of money we pay out to those with whom we contract and to do as little as possible in any way to curtail the amount and quality of service that we provide. There's a lot of things that you can work with before you finally get down to starting to cut things out for your consumer base. So if you ever see that happening, you will know. Probably you will know you should have stepped up sooner, and we probably will ask you sooner. But if it ever gets to the point where we start closing out intake for a while because of the severity of our problems, you will know it's time for you to start marching on Sacramento. Believe me. Hey, we just revised our website, www.dor.gov, to conform to state. Oh, sorry, dor.ca.gov. Thank you, and to conform with state standards. So go there and have a look once in a while. You may still find it hard to find something you're looking for. If that's the case, there's that link at the bottom of the homepage to talk to the webmaster. Specialized Services Division. I'm going to go faster here because I have some notes from different things I've heard yesterday and today that I want to make sure I get to. So I'll get through my standard speech faster. Specialized Services Division, the division I head up, I said to you before, created by the law SB 105, took effect July 1st, 2003. Our goal is to preserve and if someday we ever have the money to enhance specialized services for blind, visually impaired, deaf, and hard of hearing. We actually sit in not too bad an underdog position within that bigger, larger organization, partly due to the fact that we have the law SB 105 behind us, partly due to the fact that we are regarded as a viable group. We're also regarded as a group that has a strong advocacy arm. And that does count for something, which is why I say, if we call upon you for advocacy, you've got to come forward. We also are regarded as a worthy group. We're also regarded as a more expensive group, which does get into our conversations when it comes time to budget crunch time. We recently had our various districts given their own budgets, something that hasn't happened for more than 20 years. And our Blind Field Services District, which is one of the units under my division, which is the unit you probably know the best, it's where all of our field rehabilitation counselors are, they got their budget too. And I'm happy to say that two things. One, we all took cuts. All of the districts took cuts, including the Blindfield Services District. But we didn't take as big a cut as some. We stayed about the same as others. fared no worse than anybody, and still have a disproportionately higher budget than you would think from the size of our population, which means that our budget still takes into account the extra expense of the rehabilitation process, the assistive technology procurement, and things of that nature for our population. So the organization as a whole has stepped up, has honored its commitment to us, I just think that, we're getting real good at advocating for ourselves up there, I must say. I've got good people behind me. I got good people in the field. I've got very loud consumers out there, and I've got my own powers of persuasion, such as they are, and together we have managed to keep ourselves from being hurt worse than we could have been. Now, if you consider that good news, fine. You know, I hope that someday that's not the good news. I hope the good news is, hey, we got all the money we need, and we can start doing some innovation, some expansion, because I got a lot of dreams for things that we can do in the future that have just had to been put on the shelf for a long time while we put out these fires. Okay, my units are Blind Field Services Unit, that's the field unit, 66 counselor capacity, 9 supervisors, 9 supervisory units spread out around the state. We are physically housed in the DOR branch offices, DOR district offices, and we have some specialists, some administrators, including the district administrator, Catherine Bales, who runs that unit. And that's the unit that has around 5,000 consumers in it at any one time. That's the unit that we count on to help folks to achieve their employment goals. I'm going to go back to them in a minute with some notes about some things that people have asked about how they are functioning. But let me get to the next unit. It's my Orientation Center for the Blind, OCB, in Albany, California. And I know they have a reunion today. And the OCB is a residential training center. It has a dormitory capacity of around 35. We have an ideal consumer census rate of around 28 to 30 consumers. So even though the dorm can hold 35, if we have around 28 to 30 consumers, we think we've maxed out the staff at that point. There's a total of 31 employees at the OCB, but only about 8 or 9 of them are actual teachers. We have groundskeepers, cooks, clerical folks, dorm counselors, the administrator, business officer. That's the one that helps us buy all the food and, you know, all the supplies to run the center. It is a center. I mean, there are buildings. Things have to be taken care of, and boilers have to get replaced. So there's a lot of stuff in running an institution. So that's why there's 31 employees there. But about 9 or 10 of them are teachers. And we have one rehab counselor. That position is vacant right this minute. We're looking to fill it soon. We're also in a program improvement plan with the OCB. Thanks to the generosity of you and the NFBC sending resolutions our way, and to our own analysis, we have engaged a program improvement plan for OCB. Modernization of curriculum, and other things about how do we actually run the place. And you can believe our friends over at the NFB, where I was last week, are all over me like a blanket, because they have a very highly developed program on what they think about the way residential training centers ought to be run. They want to send people in and things like that. I have told them. I tested them last week again. I said, well, how are we going to deal with the fact that we have California politics here? And we have that other organization that would be you, and they don't necessarily match in philosophy to you guys. How are we going to deal with that? I said, well, we don't really propose to deal with that. We have our philosophy. We think it's the best way. And I said, I think we're going to have a problem right from the start. So where I am with them right now is I will be respectful to everyone. I will take input from everyone. We will find our own way. That's the way we're going. We will find our own way. What's that? Individual by individual, case by case, low vision, as well as folks who have no vision at all. Okay. Okay. Oh, gosh, I'm way behind. BEP, new program manager, Deb Meyer. And I hope she's here, but she definitely was here earlier today. She presented at the Randolph Shepherd luncheon. You know, what I like about Deb is extremely goal-oriented, hard-driving, cares a lot about the program, cares a lot about the vendors, wants to make sure we get financially back on our feet, that we do things right, that we make that what we do makes sense in terms of today's business market. And that goes all the way down to how we train our new BEP vendors, how the new ones coming into the system get trained. And to that extent, we have postponed our training program so they can revamp it really from the ground up. It'll probably kick back into gear again next July, but we've had to postpone it. Sooner or later, we had to do this. And Deb said, "Okay, now is the right time. Let's do it now." We have a small, actually, California's probably got one of the larger Title VII older blind programs. That's independent living funds. It's a separate set of money from the Voc Rehab money, independent living funds to provide rehabilitation training, independent living skills to older blind folks, 55 years of age and older. We contract out all of the money to the private sector, to agencies for the blind, and just two independent living centers where there were no agencies for the blind, to hire blindness specialists to provide that training. I mentioned before my division also cares about the deaf and hard of hearing. I have just one administrative unit, my deaf and hard of hearing services unit, that provides advisement and counsel to the rehab counselors of the deaf out in the field. So we only have like an administrative technical advisement role with the deaf and hard of hearing. Someday they may want to join the fold and have a deaf field services unit like we have a blind field services unit, but right now that's not in the cards. You may have heard, some of you, that we've had to cut back. You probably heard it this way. We cut back on what we're paying our private agencies for the blind. We did change the rate structure. Some are experiencing a cut. Some are also experiencing a drop-off in referrals. We are working very closely with them to make sure that this is just a startup glitch and that things will normalize soon. In effect, they've taken cuts. Part of this budget crunch. And so what does that mean? That means government is kind of pushing back onto the private sector some of what maybe it would have done, at least in the form of reimbursements, because the government doesn't have the money. And that's the hard explanation of that. I feel really bad about it. I talk to my private agencies for the blind folks all the time. I take that personally, and I take personal responsibility for continuing my communication and dialogue with them. I pretty much told my entire staff, this is my baby. I'm going to stay in touch with those guys. Okay, here's some quick notes. Dan Kaiser yesterday mentioned a couple things about the BEP. I just want to make sure that you also hear that for all of the bad things you've heard about BEP, and Dan was a gentleman, he didn't say anything bad, but for all the bad things you've heard about BEP, we are turning ourselves around. We got program improvement plans. We asked for an internal controls audit and got one, and then it had that unfortunate title. I literally went to the audit chief and chewed her out. Why did you choose a title that said, it almost was like mismanagement? It was something along the lines of mismanagement, but it wasn't quite that. It was improper or not adequate management, inadequate management. There's a lot of details when they do an audit, and audits are they get in the trees. They get into places where the outside world really, really shouldn't be going. But this report got out, and Public Information Act and all. So now the entire world knows about some of the internal management things of our BEP. Well, be that as it may, we are on the rise. BEP is coming back. salaries for our counselors. This was brought up somewhere between yesterday and today. Salaries for our rehab counselors. Salaries for our rehab counselors are dependent upon the State Department of Personnel Administration, upon us to advocate in behalf of our counselors, upon the governor for saying to the Department of Finance, yeah, okay, I'll let you release some funds for, you know, when you go to negotiate with that union for those salaries, we'll let you play ball with them. So you see how, and really a lot depends on us because Department of Rehab hires the most rehab counselors in the state. So we are on record as pushing for increased salaries for our counselors. We're on record. We have labor manager meetings quarterly. They know this too. Somebody wanted to know what's this deal with our Social Security Administration reimbursements going to the independent living centers? What's that all about? That is a complicated question that I don't fully understand the answer to, but I do know that it was an arrangement that was made years ago, and something big was going on. Something big was going on, and the Department of Rehabilitation, in order to save something else more directly related to Voc Rehab, said, we have a responsibility in the state of California to help fund the independent living centers, but we don't want to use any of our state general fund because that general fund is what we match against those federal Voc Rehab dollars. So we need another way of, and it's a legal responsibility. And so whatever was going on, they said, okay, you know what? Whenever we rehabilitate somebody who is getting Social Security benefits, whatever they are, if that person goes to work, that person works for a year, that person gets off of benefits. They get completely off of benefits. When all that happens, the Social Security Administration reimburses us all of the rehabilitation costs that were incurred by DOR for that consumer. SSA reimburses us those dollars. Some states take those dollars and they put them right back into the VR pot. We decided years ago to put them into funding these IL centers. I still don't know exactly what forced us to go that route, except that it was an agreed-upon arrangement, partly for sure to avoid using the general fund, which would be the 22% contribution to get the 78% VR dollars. I'll try to find out more for you about that, though. I will. Budget shrinkage I already talked about with you. Generic agencies. Question was raised. Is anybody, especially in blind field services, telling our counselors not to use agencies for the blind, only to use generic agencies? The answer to that question is on a grand scale, no. On a grand scale, the policy is, and the word to counselors is, use our agencies for the blind first. What I think happened in one particular part of the state was one of our agencies for the blind, at least for one particular service, might not have had either the proper staff or something was going on, and the supervisor said for that service, for that particular part of the state, use the general agencies out there to get that service because they offer it too, because we would rather they have a professional in that particular service category do the service. I've since investigated all this. I've known about this for at least 2 weeks. I've investigated all this, and we've already had meetings, and we've had conversations with the supervisor. We've had conversations with the agency in question. I've got my people on this thing, and the bottom line here is to get the best service for our blind and visually impaired consumer that we can get. I don't automatically subscribe to the fact that an agency for the blind is always the best. Most of the time, I'll say yeah. If I don't know, I'll say yeah. That's probably the best way to go. But there are these times when we got to take a real close look at what's going on. So what you may have heard, for those of you who heard anything about this, was part of a process having to do with a specific situation. But rest assured, the rule of thumb, when possible, use the agencies for the blind first. That is the end of my notes, end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Tony, thank you. Great information and a good wide-ranging presentation. We certainly appreciate it. We're behind schedule, but I will take two questions.
I believe that a major component of the long-term solution to the blindness unemployment rate is to promote entrepreneurship. What would your response be to that? And if you have some sympathy with that point of view, what do you think the Department of Rehabilitation can do to make that happen?
To promote entrepreneurship as a way of alleviating the high unemployment rate for blind, visually impaired people? Statistically, no. No chance. Conceptually, in terms of people being entrepreneurs and wanting to go out there and make a living that way, I love that concept. I'm totally behind that concept. But it's not going to alleviate the high unemployment rate of blind and visually impaired people. Very small percentage of people in general are entrepreneurs. The great majority of the people we work with, great majority of you, are not entrepreneurs in the sense of what I understand that word to be. So I'm giving you two answers there, yes and no. Yes, entrepreneurship is fine. Here's how we put our money where our mouth is. We just revised our self-employment regulations to actually make it easier for both you and for us to work with you on self-employment plans. And we are actually even tailoring our BEP program in that direction. And educating and training our counselors better. The main group of people, though, they're not going to really make their living through entrepreneurship. They're going to make their living through what we call our traditional way of going to work.
Tony, who's the entrepreneur contact for anybody who wants to know?
Our workforce development unit in DOR, we don't have a Blindfield Services entrepreneur contact. Our self-employment coordinator is a lady named Michelle Alford Williams, and she is in our workforce development unit in DOR, so she's over all of the DOR for that, Michelle Alford Williams. But if you want to get a hold of me and help me to hook you up with whatever you need to be hooked up with, feel free.
Great. Okay, thank you. Hey. One more question.
Hey, Tony. It's Tricia Leitz. I'm the chair of the rehab committee for CCB here, and one of the things that our committee has been having some trouble with that we addressed last year with Tony Sauer is our computers are still working really slow, and when we go to open up an attachment, it will crash. It doesn't happen to everybody, but it does happen. It seems to be funny. The ones that spend money, it's all happening to us. We're not really sure what... It's been going on for, well, over a year.
Okay, I got the question.
Okay.
It's an internal infrastructure problem that we're having in DOR and probably in other governmental agencies. Our systems are and our equipment, especially our transmission equipment, is older than what the load requires now. And so what with so much high memory gobbling video and audio streaming technology out there and so much data going over the wires, we literally are clogged up. And so we have a transmission, we call it our bandwidth improvement project, underway. Funding is being secured, may actually have the funding, to change the equipment so that this infrastructure problem that we have, our Office of Technology, the California Office of Technology, I'm forgetting the proper name of it, is completely aware of this problem. So as your government goes through its ups and downs, remember, it still has to keep on running, and that means even though there's hardly any money, it still actually has to spend money to keep itself up. And one of the ways it's doing that is to increase the transmission speed of its computer systems, so people like Tricia and others out there in the field can actually do their work without going completely bonkers. I understand that. You're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tony Candela, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next speaker now I'd like to introduce. Catherine Weed joined Disability Rights Advocates in 2007. She specializes in class action and other high-impact disability rights litigation. She's worked on precedent-setting ADA cases in areas such as employment, government services, emergency preparedness, education, mental health, and public accommodations. Before joining DRA, Catherine worked on litigation associated at a large firm in Detroit, Michigan, focusing on employment and labor litigation. She received her law degree in 2002 from the University of Michigan Law School and her BA in English Literature and Hispanic Studies from the University of Michigan in 1999. During law school, she worked at a Center for Advice and Individual Rights in Europe, Air Center London, United Kingdom, in the area of international human rights, and she worked at a Pine Tree Legal Assistance in Maine to secure rights for immigrant farm workers. Catherine Weed is here to speak with us today about a topic near and dear to the hearts of CCB members and something also on which ACB's Advocacy Committee has focused attention for some time. And that is the topic of exit exams and other high-stakes testing and accommodation issues. She'll be addressing that for us specifically for Californians. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Catherine Weed.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chris, for that kind introduction. It's been a mostly uplifting afternoon. Tom addressed us initially about ideas for financial independence and asset building. Christian addressed exciting clinical trials and stem cell research issues. Tony talked about vocational rehabilitation and how to improve some of those statistics about employment in our community. Now I want to go back in the cycle a little bit to when young people in the blind community are first getting their start and graduating high school and entering the adult world with their proud, brand new high school diploma, ready to start putting all their money in their IDA, putting it toward their down payment, and then wait, no, they don't get a diploma because they are required now, with the class of 2007 and 2008 being the first class, to take the California High School Exit Exam. In the past, there's a long history behind this test, which I will get into, but this is the first year that it's gone into effect for all students in California, including students with disabilities, and it's had a devastating impact that we hope to overcome in the near future. So I am an attorney at Disability Rights Advocates, as Chris was mentioning, and I am very fortunate to be part of impact litigation. I'm not sure if any of you have had, I know many of you are advocates, but I'm not sure if any of you have been involved in litigation in the past, but we see it oftentimes as a lever. as Tony was saying, sometimes when you can't do things internally within the system, it takes a little bit of external pressure to get people to pay attention. And our attitude has always been, you know, we don't love suing people. That's not our first goal. We usually send a demand letter first, and we try to talk and negotiate, sometimes get into mediation. But in the end, when something is not accomplished, sometimes the most powerful tool that we have is litigation. So DRA has been involved in litigation and investigation of several major standardized high-stakes tests, including the California Exit Exam, which I'll call CAESE, the MCAT test for admission to medical schools, the LSAT test for admission to law schools, and the SATs for college admission. As I'll explain later on, this is just one of the many issues that we handle at DRA. We also represent people with disabilities on many different issues, including physical access barriers and public accommodations, government services and parks, access to technology such as online stores, travel services, public utility sites, and other important places on the internet. One of my major practice areas right now is emergency preparedness for people with disabilities. We currently have a case pending against the city of Oakland, and we are also investigating some other large cities that are close to the location of this convention. So should any of you have any stories in that area, particularly given the recent wildfires around here and the July earthquake, and we know that we live in a very emergency-prone state, we would be curious to hear any of those experiences, as that will help us with our investigation. We do not ever charge a fee to our clients for our legal services. We are a nonprofit organization devoted to improving access, independence, and protecting the rights of people with all forms of disability. And I will give you my contact information at the end of the presentation if you have any stories that you'd like to share with me. So that's enough about DRA. I'll get on to the Casey now. As many of you are aware, California, as of this year, started requiring its high school students to take an exit exam before they could graduate from high school and receive a high school diploma. This idea initially came about with the passage of the No Child Left Behind Act. In 1999, the California legislature passed legislation directing the Superintendent of Education to develop a high school exit exam in mathematics and language arts. To do this, the Department of Education hired a contractor, which promptly found that such a test would discriminate against students with disabilities. And that became the consistent finding with all of the research that had occurred both before this idea and afterward. DRA and other disability advocacy groups immediately became involved, and their intervention resulted in large part in a piece of legislation which mandated a specific study to take place on students with disabilities. And it ultimately postponed the implementation of the Casey graduation penalty for these students, which saved 50,000 disabled students who are on track to graduate but might have failed the Casey in those first few years. So the educational research has shown for decades that students with disabilities can be disadvantaged by standardized tests, particularly if there's no adequate provision for accommodations, obviously. The WestEd study, which was issued in 2004 and commissioned by the state, showed that one of the main problems was that the underlying curriculum did not prepare disabled students for the exam. So what they were being tested on at the end of their high school course was not the same as what they had been learning in their classes all along. So beyond having discrimination in the accommodations, there was actually discrimination in the earlier part of the education. And so based on that study, which was issued in 2004, my organization, DRA, moved for a preliminary injunction in September of 2005, which was supposed to stop that class from being subjected to the penalty, the graduation penalty of the exam. And I think what happened was before the court ever had a chance to hear that motion, the state ended up settling with us, and that delayed the penalty for students with disabilities for 2 more years. Thus, exempting the classes of 2006 and 2007. Then another bill came up before Governor Schwarzenegger just this fall that would have delayed the high-stakes consequences of the exit exam for students with disabilities for yet 2 more years as they continue to research and try to find a better way that would make it more equal for all of the students. And unfortunately, he vetoed that legislation. So the class of 2008 was the first for all high school students, including those who had disabilities of various kinds and had been throughout special education throughout all of their years. They were subjected to the exam, and not surprisingly, what happened was that 90% of the students overall passed the exam, but only 50% of students with disabilities passed the exam, and they then could not receive their high school diploma. So that's obviously a really, really bad result. And this was directly in line with all the research that the state had seen and, in fact, commissioned with its own money in the prior couple of years. So there is a silver lining to all of this, and it's an exciting one, but the ramifications are, as of yet, unknown. On September 30th, 2008, for reasons we don't fully understand at DRA, and there's been surprisingly little press coverage, the governor signed into law Assembly Bill 2040. This bill provides for development of a panel to recommend, quote, alternative means to eligible pupils with disabilities to demonstrate they have achieved the same level of academic achievement in math and language arts. This panel is supposed to recommend, and the state board will then adopt, regulations for alternative assessment. The alternative assessment, the whole concept of it, is it includes something that's more like a portfolio of the student's work in the past, or perhaps an oral exam, or some other ideas have been, you know, an interview with the teacher and principal and other individuals at the school. There's a lot of different ideas in educational theory about what the alternative assessment should look like. And so that's something that we're thinking it would be really helpful to have input from the various communities of people with disabilities about what sort of alternative assessment would be fair and equal in this instance to replace the exam. You'd have to be able to demonstrate the same kind of skills on the exam, the mathematics and the language arts, but not in a written format. So at this stage, the law, unfortunately, has shifted out of our favor, which is why I think it finally went into effect this year, where the students with disabilities had to take the exam. There was just a very unfavorable case in the Ninth Circuit having to do with reasonable accommodations. So 23,000 students a year have been exempted from 2003 to 2007. But now, going forward, we're going to have these classes of 2008, 2009, 2010, who are going to have this really horrible consequence in their education and vocational careers. So so what we think would be the most effective tool right now is just to is lobbying and advocacy, and to try to give input to this panel that is going to be making the recommendations determining the format for the alternative assessment. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but the Assembly Bill 2040 says that the recommendations are supposed to be in place by October 1st of 2010, and for the class of 2011, students with disabilities will be eligible for the alternative assessment. So it's just really unfortunate for those classes in the middle that don't, you know, they didn't have the exemption bill, and then, you know, that there's going to be an alternative assessment in place, but for three classes, there's no accommodations. So I spoke with Julia Manning. She's the testing coordinator at the California School for the Blind. I spoke with her this week in preparation for my talk here, and I wanted to know what her students had experienced when they were studying for and taking the California exit exam. The California School offers a short course on the CASE, and so she had been involved in helping students to prepare for the test. And she mentioned to me that while her students typically did well on the test after adequate preparation and fighting for adequate accommodations and you know, knowing how to go through all of those bureaucratic ropes, they would ultimately pass the test, but they still encountered problems with various aspects of the test. And the regular problems encountered included transcription problems with the Braille version of the test, ambiguous tactile graphics in the mathematics section, which does not always properly translate. She specified that taking a long standardized test in Braille, even if a student is given extra time, it can still be laborious for some students, especially if they have recently learned Braille, or if their blindness or low vision happens to coincide with a separate motor disability, or if they have neuropathy, maybe from diabetes, that will cause a desensitization on their fingers. And so Braille may be very difficult for them as an accommodation for them to take the exam. So another sort of accommodation that is available is an audio CD or a live reader, a live scribe to help you record your answers. But the problem with those, what I would consider reasonable accommodations, because they're just helping you to take the exam the way any other student would, the California Department of Education considers some of those to be, quote, modifications. They say that it actually changes the character of the exam and does not allow the exam to test the same skills that the other students are being tested in. And what I thought was very strange is that if you take the math portion of the exam with an audio CD, then it counts as just a regular accommodation, and you can still pass the exam with that accommodation. But if you take the language arts portion with the audio CD, then it's called a, quote, modification. And then they still make you take the exam, but if you don't, well, actually, if you pass it or if you don't pass it, regardless of the results, then they make you go and get a waiver from the. You have to go first to your principal of your school, and then the principal approaches the district, and then ultimately the state grants you a waiver that says that you can still graduate without having passed the CASE. So I don't understand why they make you take the test before you go through this process. It would make a lot more sense for you to be able to go and show your individualized education plan, you know, what you've been doing all throughout school and the accommodations that you've needed, and say, look, I'll have to do this for the exam. This is the only way I can take it. And then they could make a determination at that time. But instead, they make you go through the whole process of taking the exam, either passing it or failing it, and then they afterward will make you go and get a waiver. And so I think there's been some research done on this, but just the psychological effect on a student to have to go in and take this test sometimes multiple times and fail it, and then even if they do ultimately prepare for it well and they pass it and, you know, they feel proud of themselves, then they have to go get a waiver from the school board saying that they didn't really pass the exam. So it's just, you know, a really demoralizing experience for a student of that age who's getting started, you know, trying to graduate from high school and get on with their life. So we really think there must be a better system out there to do this, and I'm very hopeful that this new bill providing for an alternative assessment will be effective in that regard. But as of right now, there's just been very little explanation of what this will mean, and of course, a lot of the shape of it is going to take place when the panel is appointed and they make their recommendations. So to those of you who have interest in this issue, I just, again, would highly encourage you to give your input. You can send it to DRA or just, you know, lobby lobby the state legislature and the panel. So let's see. So right now, the modification is a big hurdle. Having to, even when you take the exam, having to go and get that waiver, we at DRA think it's highly discriminatory and that just should not be taking place. But beyond the CASE, there's a number of other issues with test preparation for standardized tests, both the CASE and also, as I said before, the LSAT and the MCAT and the SAT and a number of other standardized tests. There's a problem with test preparation, there being not the same quantity or quality of materials for students, for all students with disabilities, but particularly students who are blind or low vision, that, you know, they might get one practice test that's in Braille, whereas another student can get dozens or hundreds even of practice tests. So they don't have nearly the same opportunity to prepare for the test. There's other issues, even with some of the accommodations. Now, given the prevalence of technology and screen readers, there are very few standardized tests. In fact, I'm not aware of a single one that will allow you to use a screen reader such as JAWS or some other software on your test or any sort of other assistive technology. And when you have then in that case, a lot of times you have a human who will help you, like a live reader or a live scribe, and then there's human errors and those kind of, you know, that I was speaking with a woman in my office who's blind, and she had recently taken the LSAT to get into law school, and she said that she showed up to her test and her live reader was on the cell phone for half the time. When she be reading through a question, the woman would talk on her phone, and when she would ask her to go and write down the answer, she would be fed up, you know, that she had to do it because she wasn't trained. I mean, she was just someone who the test center had appointed the last minute, you know, to come in on a Saturday and do it. And so I think that's a huge problem, you know, the training of the people who are assisting with the exam, and just the accommodations are just not up to date. With the curriculum, I'm sure, has problems too, but when the accommodations and the tests do not match what the students have been using in the classroom for the past 12 years of their education, that's really a problem because they're not familiar. The other thing is that they won't let you meet your live reader or scribe prior to the exam because they're worried about bias. They don't want you to establish a friendship with the person or something. But then, of course, you know, you show up and you've never had a chance to interact with this person, and they don't know how quickly you read or what your method is for answering the questions, whether you might want to go back and reread something or repeat your answers to them to make sure that they know what you said. And, of course, you have to work all of this out on the clock as you're taking the exam, you know, when the other students are already on to question 10. So even with the accommodations, even if they're granted, you know, there are a lot of problems there with the way they're administered. Another issue that we've run across with the high-stakes standardized testing is the flagging of scores. Kind of the worst example is in the Casey, where they make you get a waiver after you've taken the test saying that you never actually took it or you shouldn't have taken it. But in the case of some of the entrance exams for college and graduate school, they'll do a flagged score where they'll say, okay, the student took the exam and they got a particular score, but they took the exam with accommodations, and there's a little asterisk next to your score. And, of course, the school that you're applying to sees that, and unfortunately, I think that will affect some people's attitude because they don't I don't think it even gives information. It may not say what kind of accommodation you had or why you needed it. It doesn't give any context. It just flags your score. And so that's highly problematic, and that's something that we've been fighting against on the MCAT, and we would like to combat it with the other exams I mentioned. Let's see. Oh, so one interesting thing, and I'm sure this is a debate that many of you have had amongst your community, but it's just there's sort of a philosophical divide between educators and also within the community of individuals who are blind and visually impaired. And it's about Braille, whether Braille is sort of the only accommodation or the best accommodation to have on a standardized test. There are those who might assert that reading Braille is required to be literate, and then others would assert that Braille is no more necessary to analytic thinking than any other form of information processing. And this is reflected, obviously, in the policy of the Casey to allow you to use an audio CD for the math portion, but not for the language arts. And what came to my mind as I was thinking about that was that there's obviously populations who are fully capable of being educated, but just can't read for one reason or another, whether it is someone who's fully blind and could read Braille, but for a motor impairment or something else that would prevent them from being able to do that. And then there's also, this could be analogized also to the learning disabled community, which formed a large part of our class in the MCAT case and in our litigation about the Casey as well, because they can understand and process concepts with no problem, but they can't decode the written material on the page. And so what happens when you have a quote, standardized test with an individual who cannot read for one reason or another, someone who's fully capable of being educated but can't actually read a code on the page. So that's just kind of an interesting idea, and I think it's something that the alternative assessment panel will be considering in detail as they come up with the protocol for the alternative assessment. So DRA is always challenging access barriers on behalf of all people with disabilities, but also blind and low vision clients. One of our recent victories was getting a settlement with Target on a website that was not accessible to screen readers. This is Target, the retail store, and Target.com was found in 2006 to have thousands of images on the website which lacked text equivalents. There was no accommodation to facilitate keyboard navigation and a number of other problems. So in that case, the court found that the website was a place of public accommodation and that no nexus needed to be shown between the website and the physical store. And that was the first time that a court had come out and said that so firmly and explicitly, and that's a really big deal when it comes to accessibility on the internet. So that's something that my organization is looking into a lot at this time. We're looking into other cases involving other websites. We thought, we try to do high impact litigation, so we're thinking about the things that affect people the most. And so we're looking at travel services and government websites, any kind of case we have involving the government. We always make a big aspect of our advocacy having to do with accessibility of their website, for people being able to get to the information. So we'd be curious to hear about any barriers that you encountered on the internet. We have another one, a healthcare case with the Kaiser Health System involving Braille on prescription bottles. And so that's, access to healthcare is a big, one of our big causes right now. And we find that, ironically enough, in hospitals and pharmacies and healthcare facilities where you would expect everything to be fully accessible, those places are often the worst. A lot of times there will be a a table, you know, an examination table. If someone's in a wheelchair, there's no way for them to get up onto that table. Sometimes there's not even, you know, a way for them to get in the building in some of the older facilities, the VA hospitals. So we're looking for any sort of stories that you would have on the issue of access to health care. Prescriptions is one that we've been looking at recently. And Caltrans. Caltrans marches forward. The state case, the federal case, it's been really convoluted. Yeah, it's... Oh, you did? So, yeah, I think that's pretty much... Yes. Oh, yeah. Sorry, this is Disability Rights Advocates. We have a case now against Caltrans, which incidentally tried to show that the ADA was unconstitutional. That was one of their major arguments. It was unbelievable. Fortunately, they did not succeed on that particular argument. So anyway, so I'll just give you, my name again is Catherine Weed. I'm a staff attorney. My phone number is 510-665-8644. And if you want any more information about any of these cases, but in particular right now, the Target claims process, if any of you are interested in that, if you would want to file a claim against Target, the settlement has been processed and approved by the court, and you can find that on our website, which is www.dralegal.org.
Catherine, thank you very much. Great presentation.
Thank you.
We're a little past 4 o'clock, but would people like to have a couple of questions?
Hello, Catherine. My name is David Jackson.
Hi, Dave.
I want to go back to the testing centers.
Yes.
Are there any cases pending to these testing centers? I guess, in other words, what I'm getting at, if I'm a person that's going for my social work credential or my MCAT, these places are not, because everything is done on computer.
Uh-huh.
So... they're not using software to accommodate those individuals who, for whatever disability they have, they're not able to access the test.
Are you talking about the physical center itself?
Yes,
where you
have to go and you have to pay $150 to sit in and take a test.
Huh. We actually have not looked, to my knowledge, we have not looked at that particular issue. We've been focused more on the test company itself.
Uh-huh.
They're the ones responsible for administering the test in a successful way.
Let's have order in the front, please.
No, but it would be interesting to see if there was... I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with the testing center, so know if there's one company...
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. We have one in the Bay Area, or I guess we have one that I'm aware of. And you go to this place. They have multiple tests that you can take. You pay whatever it is that they're asking you to pay.
Uh-huh.
And you sit in front of a computer for X amount of hours. You have no paper, no cell phone, no anything. You can't leave. You can't go to the bath, all that kind of stuff. So what I'm asking is, you don't have any case now with these.
Not centers. Against testing centers,
okay.
No, but it's
okay.
Something to consider.
Okay.
So yeah, why don't you, I don't know if I gave my email or not. But,
yeah, I've got it.
Okay. Okay.
Catherine Weed, I've
Catherine
got that.
Catherine Weed, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Get in touch with me and we'll think about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One more question.
Catherine, it's Mitch Pomerantz. I actually think we've spoken before.
Oh, yes, we have. Hi, Mitch.
Hi. I'm soon to be retired as the city's ADA compliance officer, and we've heard rumors about what you're doing. And I suspect that one of my staff people who's involved in emergency preparedness, we've had a lot of problems with L.A. County and with the Red Cross. I suspect we'd both be very happy to talk to you, and we'll even do it during work time.
Well, you know what? That's fantastic. That would always, always, always be our preference, and we've done that with a few communities prior to this, and it's been very successful.
Yeah,
so.
I don't have any cards with me, but if you want to...
I know your name.
You know how to reach me, right?
Yes, I'm glad to reach you.
Please give me a call in the next couple of months, because after the 31st of December, I'm gone.
Okay, good to know. I will let Larry know that, Larry and Sid. So,
yeah, and Larry and I know each other very well.
Yes, I know. Thank you, Mitch.
Okay. Anybody else have one more burning question? All right. Catherine, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Brian Freeborn, are you in the room?
Yes, sir.
Brian would like to make a brief announcement that I think we'll all be interested in. So, Brian, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
And when he's done, we'll do one last door prize.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Brian Freeborn. I serve as a job development consultant in Orange County and also L.A. I have been involved with the blind and visually impaired for 30 years, ever since I was 19 years old. I serve now as an independent service provider to the State Department of Rehabilitation for Blind Field Services. As you know, the unemployment rate for the state of California right now has risen to about 8%, and a lot of people are very concerned about that. Well, your unemployment rate is 10 times that, 80%, and that concerns me, and that's not acceptable. And I'm here to help in any way I can. I've been involved with I've started up an agency for the blind back in 1997 called CAB, Community Alliance for the Blind, in Whittier. At that time, the unemployment rate for the blind and visually impaired was 80%. That rate is still the same 10 years later. We have to do a lot more to work with employers, a lot more to work on the skills that it takes to get any of you that want to work out there in the workplace. One of the basic things that I work on as individually with clients is self-esteem. To me, if you don't have the self-esteem to answer a simple question in an interview like, what are your three biggest strengths, how do you expect to get a job? So I'm working on self-esteem. I work on the empowerment. Work on those skills to make you believe in yourself because you can work. You can do and find your passion out there. With people like myself and other people out there, we would like to help and serve you more. But we need to get out to the different chapters and different groups and working with you as individuals. So again, I offer that to you. I do not just self-esteem, but I do work on all job skills training from resume writing, critiquing, to interview skills, and networking. 75% of all jobs are gotten through networking. Not through the internet, not through the computer systems, but by networking. People who know people who know people who have jobs and are willing to work and get you out there. So that's one of the things that I work on is getting you to work and get out there more of the networking. So again, I encourage you through either through your groups or chapters to have me come out and speak to help you guys. I also do individual consulting. I'm going to stick around outside here, outside of the in the lobby area. Again, my name is Brian Freeborn. I'm going to give you my email address. My email address is FDR, as in Freeborn Diversified Resources, FDR.Freeborn@gmail.com. Again, that's FDR.Freeborn@gmail.com. If I could be of service to you in any way, shape, or form, you have questions, please come see me. I'll stick around for the next half hour, 45 minutes outside the lobby here. Just ask for Brian. Freeborn is FREEBORN, just like born free. Freeborn. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much. What a great afternoon, and we'll see you at the banquet. We're now in recess.